Chapter 1. My Path Towards Regenerative Medicine. Progress is impossible without change, and those who cannot change their minds cannot change anything. George Bernard Shaw. I grew up in a medical family. My father was a physician with a home office where my mother, a nurse, worked alongside him. When they were not working or traveling, they enjoyed entertaining, especially other physicians. And my mother was a marvelous cook. I spent countless evenings seated at our dining room table, listening to them talk shop over leisurely dinners. My father was passionate about patient care. On Sundays, while we watched football games, my dad would lie prone on the living room carpet, surrounded by stacks of medical journals he was reading and index cards filled with handwritten notes. When I was in college, he and I co-wrote a paper on abnormal brainwave patterns in patients with agoraphobia, an anxiety disorder. Those experiences instilled in me great respect and admiration for the field of medicine. It was clear to me that medicine is a calling, and I wanted to be part of that world of care and healing. As a matter of fact, I was not the only one to heed the call. All of my siblings are physicians, and now members of the next generation of our family are on their way into medicine as well. When I was accepted into medical school, my parents and I were over the moon. I had my heart set on becoming an orthopedic surgeon. The first 2 years focused primarily on book learning and testing. The third and fourth years were spent in practical electives, rotating through a variety of specialties, rotations, where we actually interacted with and treated patients under supervision. As you might imagine, by my fourth year, I couldn't wait to finally begin my orthopedic rotation. It was 1987, Ronald Reagan was president, the New York Giants had won the Super Bowl, and I was in my final year of medical school. Beth was my very first orthopedic patient. It was a challenge even to examine her. Not only was she in a great deal of pain, but she was also upset and exhausted. Beth was relatively young, in her 40s, a wife and mom of four kids who had suffered for years from chronic lower back pain,
CLBP,
due to degenerative disc disease,
DDD.
She had tried all the traditional treatments, oral medication, physical therapy, chiropractic care, spinal injections, and time, none of which had given her any sustained relief. Frustrated, she went to a spine surgeon who told her he could, quote, fix her problem by fusing her spine with screws and rods. Following the spinal fusion, Beth was in even worse pain than before. Implants in the spine can sometimes become a breeding ground for bacterial growth. The screws that held Beth's spines together had become infected, and the only way to eradicate the infection was for her to undergo a second spinal surgery to remove the spinal implants and irrigate the wound with antibiotics. I walked into Beth's room just after that second surgery. Beth saw me, a medical student, as a nuisance, the source of yet another exam requiring her to gingerly shift positions. Her distress was understandable. After all, she was recovering from her second spinal surgery in less than 2 weeks, and she was required to take daily pain medication, which worsened her depression. She would now need to spend several more weeks bedridden, receiving massive doses of intravenous antibiotics to try and fight the infection. Even if her recovery progressed as planned and hoped, she would still need to undergo a third spinal surgery to redo the fusion and stabilize her spine so that she could walk again. In the 1980s, the use of spinal implants usually involved hooks and rods and was typically reserved for patients who had scoliosis, a curvature of the spine. A spine bone screw and plate system was not the typical surgery for patients with lower back pain from degenerative discs. At that time, there was a lot of experimentation going on with these types of spinal implants. New pedicle screw systems and surgical techniques were being invented and reinvented with the goal of achieving a solid spinal fusion. Practitioners hope the elimination of motion and load on degenerative discs would relieve patients' back pain.
Dr. Art Steffi, who is considered by many to be the father of modern spine surgery,
invented a pedicle screw system in 1982 that could be used in the lower back. The spine stabilizing system is what Beth had received. In his initial publication, Dr. Steffi mentioned a 90% quote success rate. However, he subsequently admitted that his follow-up period was too short. Out of 120 patients, there were 7 deep infections, 2 nerve injuries, 8 broken screws, and 5 loose screws that had to be removed. So if you add up these complications, his reported 90% success rate was optimistic at best. Even so, he later founded a spine implant company called Acromed and sold it to DePuy in 1998 for $325 million. Beth was one of the early pedicle screw fusion cases. She had exhausted all of the traditional conservative treatments at that time without success, and, like many patients in her circumstance, she had to make a very difficult decision. Should she continue to live with unbearable pain, or should she take the risk of undergoing a relatively new type of spinal fusion surgery? The day I met Beth, I performed the best exam that I could under the circumstances. As I walked home that evening, I couldn't stop thinking about her and her suffering. Here was a woman who, just like my own mom, was responsible for raising 4 children. Her pain was interfering with her family life, and she'd undergone surgery in the hope of reclaiming her mobility. Now she was fighting for her life. The next morning, I performed my rounds. When I reached Beth's room, her bed was empty. Curious, I went to the nurse's station to ask what room they'd moved her to. "Beth died last night," the nurse responded apologetically. The pen I was holding fell from my hand. Those were not the words I expected to hear. I felt shocked and nauseous. Overnight, Beth had developed a blood clot that had traveled to her lungs, killing her instantly. This is called a pulmonary embolism. This complication was a direct result of her 2 recent surgeries, the infection she was fighting, and the bed rest her recovery required. She probably had not needed such an aggressive spinal surgery, but she decided to proceed, and now she was dead. It was the worst outcome possible. I knew there had to have been a safer way to treat chronic lower back pain patients like Beth. I did not yet know what that solution would be, but even as a green medical student, I sensed that fusions could not be the answer for most patients suffering from CLBP. There had to be something better than cutting a disc out and fusing the spine with screws and rods. Looking back, I can see now how the medical establishment failed Beth twice. First, when she tried conservative treatments that were ineffectual, and second, when she underwent a spinal fusion because there was nothing better to offer her. I carried my experience with Beth throughout my entire professional career, and it proved to be pivotal in pursuing a path outside of orthopedic surgery. While outcomes like Beth's are thankfully rare, that experience motivated me to devote a large portion of my career to preventing other patients from suffering the same fate. It led me to a lesser-known medical specialty and answers in the unlikeliest of places. Most importantly, it caused me to find a safe potential solution for the type of chronic disabling back pain that had ultimately led to her death. A new journey in medicine. After Beth's death, I was ready to take a break from surgery. In medical school, students spend a period of time rotating through each major medical specialty, supervised by resident and attending physicians. I began my next rotation in physical medicine and rehabilitation, PM&R, also called physiatry. This rotation intrigued me, as it took a different approach to musculoskeletal issues and care. Physiatrists, or rehabilitation physicians, have broad training in medicine, neurology, and orthopedics. We tend to emphasize using non-surgical treatments to manage patients with a wide variety of neurologic and musculoskeletal conditions. Gradually, I came to realize that physiatry was the specialty for me. I continued my training during my residency at the Mayo Clinic, where, unlike most hospitals at that time, the physiatry department was at the forefront of patient care. Patients who presented at the clinic with chronic lower back pain
were first sent to a physiatrist
to obtain an accurate diagnosis and optimize their non-surgical care before considering any surgical intervention. In the rare circumstance that a patient needed surgery imminently,
the physiatrist
called in a spine surgeon to see the patient. What a common sense approach. Offer the least invasive treatment options first and give the body a chance to heal before intervening with more aggressive surgical treatments. After my PM&R residency, I was fortunate enough to begin a sports medicine fellowship at the Hospital for Special Surgery, HSS, in New York. HSS was, and still is, an orthopedic surgery mecca. It boasts the best of the best orthopedic surgeons, not only in the country but in the world. As of 2022, HSS had been ranked number one in orthopedics for the past 12 consecutive years by U.S. News and World Report. When I started at HSS in the early 1990s, there was no
physiatry department,
and I struggled to find my footing. However, I eventually found an excellent mentor in Dr. Russell Warren, who was a gifted, open-minded orthopedic surgeon, chief of sports medicine, and the team physician for the New York Giants. After my fellowship at HSS ended, Dr. Warren hired me to improve the non-surgical care of patients at HSS. A few years later, he became surgeon-in-chief and asked me to start and chair the first ever physiatry department at HSS in 1997. Looking back, without his support and vision, I do not know if HSS ever would have had
a physiatry department.
I was just 35 years old and chief of physiatry at HSS. My career path forward began to unfold in front of me. To say it was a bit intimidating to start a brand new
physiatry department
in this environment is an understatement. Although I was relatively young in my career, I was convinced early on that surgery was not the answer for most patients with chronic low back pain. The problem I had at that point was I just didn't know what to do with patients who did not respond to non-surgical care. I saw how big a problem chronic low back pain was, but I did not understand the underlying mechanisms that made the pain become chronic and resistant to standard treatments. Happily, I can report that decades later, we have discovered a simple and safe treatment that I believe will transform how the medical field treats patients with chronic low back pain. The history of HSS. HSS, the oldest and one of the most prestigious orthopedic hospitals in the world, has a unique history. The hospital was founded by Dr. James Knight in 1863, in the middle of the American Civil War. At the time, hospitals were overwhelmed and unable to take care of children who were sick and suffering from orthopedic deformities. In order to address the needs of those patients, Dr. Knight turned his home into a 28-bed hospital and called it the New York Society for the Relief of the Ruptured and Crippled. In that era, given the frequency and severity of surgical infections, few, if any, surgeries were performed during Dr. Knight's tenure. Most of Dr. Knight's patients received care in the form of exercise, bracing, and better nutrition, non-surgical care. Things changed in 1887, however, when Dr. Virgil Gibney became surgeon-in-chief. He brought not only the first x-ray machine, but also the first operating room to HSS. For the next 100 years, the hospital's focus shifted to providing surgical solutions for patients with orthopedic problems through patient care, research, and education. The name was later changed to Hospital for Special Surgery to reflect that focus. During the tenure of Dr. Russell F. Warren, Surgeon-in-Chief from 1993 to 2003, I was asked to start the first physiatry department of its kind in the country. I was Chief of Physiatry for 15 years and built it into one of the largest outpatient interventional orthopedic practices in the country. Our mission was to provide orthopedic patients with state-of-the-art non-surgical care. I like to think my efforts would have been pleasing to Dr. Knight by swinging the pendulum back to a more balanced approach to patient care. Sometimes inspiration comes from the unlikeliest of places. As you can imagine, running a major department as a young physician was tremendously stressful. My days were long and included a regular commute from my home in Princeton, New Jersey, to New York City. "You need to slow down," my wife told me. So I did, and we found a beautiful farm in Hopewell, New Jersey. We had always dreamed of raising our kids on a farm, and I reduced my time at HSS to 4 days a week. Those 3 days off at the farm were incredibly therapeutic for me. I would turn off the hospital stress and recharge, driving the tractor, fixing fences, and riding horses with my kids. One day, as I sat in the stable with a very skilled veterinarian, Dr. Daniel Keenan, as he attended to a lame horse, I had my, quote, aha moment. Dan took a large amount of blood from the horse, spun it in a centrifuge to concentrate the cells, and then re-injected it under ultrasound into the horse's partially torn tendon. This was a new treatment at that time called platelet-rich plasma, PRP. Prior to this experience, I had never heard of PRP. Historically, while anti-inflammatory medications such as steroids helped horses feel better temporarily, they were rarely a cure and often had to be repeated. Repeating steroid injections is a problem because it weakens the tendon, often leading to a complete rupture. PRP was different, and the results I saw were simply amazing. After the injections, our once lame horse transformed in just a few weeks, running around the field like a young colt. And the most shocking part, the horse stayed better and never had to be injected again. "You should be doing this on your patients," Dan said. I began to read the scientific literature on PRP.
Interestingly,
much of the science was coming out of the fields of dental and veterinary medicine, not orthopedics or physiatry. The more I read, the more I became intrigued with this emerging field of regenerative medicine. As I watched our horse gallop happily across the field, I considered that, just maybe, this could work for my patients suffering from chronic low back pain. The same collagen, type 1, that makes up tendons also makes up the outer fibrous rings of the discs in our spines. At that point in time, there were no published clinical studies on using PRP in the disc. I immediately ordered a centrifuge and some PRP kits, the same kits Dr. Keenan had used on our horses. Because PRP is made up solely of the body's own cells and healing proteins, and not considered a drug, a full FDA trial at that time was not needed to begin to explore treating patients with this new therapy. What is platelet-rich plasma? If you want to know the fascinating science behind how you can use your body's own cells to create healing, this section is for you. Platelet-rich plasma, PRP, is a regenerative medicine treatment. It's autologous, meaning it's derived from your own blood. First, the blood is drawn, collected, and placed into a centrifuge to separate and concentrate the cellular components. Spinning at that speed creates three distinct layers. Blood plasma on top, the buffy coat that contains mainly platelets and white blood cells in the middle,
and then the red blood cell layer on the bottom.
The majority of red blood cells are then discarded, leaving the buffy coat full of platelets and white blood cells in the plasma. These are spun a second time to further concentrate them, creating PRP. PRP contains a highly concentrated dose of your own healing platelets with thousands of different proteins, growth factors, that promote wound healing and tissue regeneration. Platelets are not really cells, but rather fragments of cells called megakaryocytes. Wherever PRP is placed, it simply ignites your own natural healing cascade. The concept is pretty simple. When you suffer an injury to your skin and start bleeding, platelets are the first to the wound. They aggregate and form a clot to stop the bleeding. But that's not all they do. They then release a multitude of proteins called growth factors that signal waiting stem cells called pericytes on your blood vessels to come to the wound and begin the healing process. Your body does this on its own beautifully wherever there is good blood flow to the area, such as the skin or muscle. The problem arises when you have an injury in an area with poor blood flow, such as a tendon, a spinal disc, or cartilage. In those areas, natural healing is often slow or incomplete. By injecting PRP precisely into these areas, you jumpstart your own innate ability to heal. Personalized medicine at its best. Figure 1. This is how PRP is prepared. We draw your blood and place it into a centrifuge, and the cells of the blood are concentrated and separated into different layers. Erythrocytes are your red blood cells and go to the bottom of the tube. Then there is the buffy coat, which is composed of white blood cells and platelets. Plasma is the protein portion of the blood. We can now aspirate the concentrated platelets and white blood cells into the plasma to make the PRP to inject. A new hope for patients. By chance, on the very first day my PRP kits arrived at my HSS office, a 70-year-old patient, James, came hobbling in with a chronic tear in his Achilles tendon. These PRP kits were one of the first to be commercially developed. They consisted of syringes to draw blood and containers to place into a centrifuge to spin the blood, which would then concentrate healing cells to about 5 times normal blood levels. I knew that I did not want to begin experimenting by using PRP in the spine, which is a much more sensitive and risky area than a tendon. Based upon his injury and condition, James seemed like a possible candidate. But it was definitely a long shot. His injury was not a complete tear, but it was severe, roughly 70% torn, which would normally make him a surgical candidate. In pain and wanting to avoid surgery, he had been walking around in a boot for protection for 6 months with no signs of healing. Coincidentally, as a hedge fund manager, James had invested in a company making PRP kits, so he understood the technology and the research behind it. He'd gone to different orthopedic surgeons, and all had recommended surgery. When he came to me to explore the non-surgical options, he asked, "Why is no one willing to try injecting PRP into my tendon? I came to you because I heard you might try this." Now let me repeat, this was the very first day I received the PRP kits in my office. Here was a patient asking for PRP, and I was looking for a patient to try it on. Fate? Divine intervention? A coincidence? You can make your own judgment. I made James no promises and certainly had significant doubts about it working, but what could be safer than using your own cells to potentially heal yourself?
Just to give you some more perspective,
in my busy sports medicine practice at HSS, I had never seen an Achilles tendon tear the size of James ever heal on its own. I agreed with all the surgeons he had seen. He needed surgery. But I was willing to explore the PRP as an option because I knew it was safe. I told him it was a definite long shot, but James was used to taking long shots in his hedge fund. He said, "Makes sense to me, so I'm game because I really would prefer to avoid surgery." Carefully, we drew approximately 60 teaspoons of James's blood and spun it for 15 minutes in a centrifuge, resulting in approximately 5 teaspoons of PRP. This very simple spinning method separates out the components of the blood so that the heavier cells get layered out from the bottom up. Red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets, and the plasma rises to the top. Figure 1. Then, under sterile conditions and local anesthesia, I guided the needle under ultrasound precisely into the tear in James's Achilles tendon. As I injected the PRP, I could see that the tear was worse than what the MRI had shown. Nevertheless, I administered the treatment into the tear and surrounding areas. He experienced only mild discomfort afterwards. I sent James home and told him to return for a follow-up visit in a month. At his next visit, we were both pleasantly surprised. His pain was significantly better, but not 100%, so I performed a second PRP injection. When he returned months later, his pain was gone, and he told me he had played tennis for the first time in over a year. "Not so fast," I said. "Let's see if the tendon is healed before you try tennis again." When we repeated the MRI, figure 2, the Achilles tendon tear had completely healed. It looked completely normal. In all of my years of medical practice, I'd never seen an injury like his heal without surgery. He was ecstatic, and I was happily surprised. You usually do not hit a home run with your first at-bat, but that's what it felt like. Figure 2. The MRI image on the left is a side view of James's left ankle showing a large tear of the Achilles tendon, arrow. The area of white inside the black tendon is the tear. The MRI image on the right is James's left ankle 6 months after his PRP injection, showing a completely healed Achilles tendon,
arrow.
A normal tendon should look completely black on the MRI. The skeptic in me thought maybe this was a fluke. So, to prove the procedure's efficacy, we began injecting PRP into other patients with chronic tendon tears that had not responded to non-surgical care. All of our tendon injections are done precisely under ultrasound imaging. What's so nice about this is that we can track healing with the ultrasound very simply in the office. It only takes a few minutes, unlike an MRI, which can take up to an hour, and costs a great deal more than an ultrasound. Previously, surgery had been the only thing left to offer such patients who had not responded to oral medication and physical therapy. Now I wondered, what did they have to lose? My surgical colleagues were very skeptical, and so was I at first, but one by one, the majority of our patients started to heal in just a few weeks. We achieved a high success rate. And other than some increased pain that resolved after the first few days, there were no complications. Almost every patient was getting better. Those we'd have previously sent to months of physical therapy and ultimately tendon surgery if that failed, were now getting better with a simple 30-minute outpatient procedure that used their own cells. Talk about personalized medicine, how much more personalized could it get? I quickly realized that regenerative medicine using PRP and other cell therapies had the potential to change orthopedics as we knew it, offering new hope for patients seeking alternatives to surgery. The lingering question I had at this point was whether this treatment could have the same effect on patients with degenerative disc disease, which is the number one cause of chronic low back pain. What was also so encouraging is that not only were patients feeling better, but their ultrasound images were also showing structural changes in the tendon. Chronic tears were disappearing, and the tendon was looking normal again. Could PRP be just the answer I was searching for to help my chronic low back pain patients? After all, most of these chronic low back pain patients have painful tears in their discs, very similar to tears in tendons. Could regenerative medicine hold the answer for your pain? Yes, there is new hope for patients with chronic low back pain. It is not a new drug or a new type of surgery. It's turning inside and using your own healing cells, precisely guided to where they need to go with a simple outpatient injection procedure. Everything you need to heal is already inside of you. As you will learn, all it takes is a special type of PRP designed specifically for inside of the disc, a type of PRP very similar to the one that healed James's Achilles tendon tear. Are you struggling with chronic low back pain? You are not alone, and I'm here to help you make better decisions about your spine care based on my 30 years of clinical experience treating tens of thousands of patients with chronic lower back pain. You will learn just how big a problem chronic lower back pain is, not just in the United States, but globally. It is another pandemic that we have not overcome with our current treatment strategies. The number of patients suffering from chronic lower back pain just keeps growing, and our current treatments often fall short of patient expectations. Our traditional treatments of drugs and surgery are not root cause treatments. These types of treatments are palliative at best. Instead of focusing on how to cure lower back pain, we have focused on suppressing the symptoms with steroid injections and opioids, or even cutting out discs and fusing the spine to try to get rid of the source of the pain. Why are you in pain? I'll help you uncover the answer and walk you through the reasons why. Painful, unhealed tears inside your degenerating discs are the number one cause of chronic lower back pain. Bacteria play a greater role than we previously realized in degenerative disc disease and chronic lower back pain. Early intervention with special kind of intradiscal PRP may be killing two birds with one stone, stimulating healing and killing bacteria. To devise better solutions, we first need to better understand the underlying mechanisms that cause discs to degenerate. Only then can we devise treatment strategies that not only get to the root causes, but also prevent or reverse these degenerative processes to keep your spine healthy. The goal should be to heal without cutting and intervene early so that the spine does not degenerate into more severe deformities that create so much long-term pain and disability for patients. What are my alternatives to spinal surgery? My entire medical career, I have been searching for a better solution to treat chronic lower back pain than spinal surgery. After decades of looking for a safe solution, I think we have found one. It is not a drug or a surgery. It is your own innate capacity to heal using your own cells. No drug or surgery will ever mimic what the body already has evolved to do so well. I will introduce you to this revolutionary new spinal procedure that we have researched and performed safely now for over 10 years. It takes less than an hour, does not require any hospitalization, does not require general anesthesia, requires very little time off from work, and is a fraction of the cost of spinal surgery, and carries significantly less risk than traditional surgical treatments. For most patients, this procedure is one and done. Rarely does it have to be repeated, and if it does, it usually provides further improvement. This information is too important not to share. There have been many promising treatments for chronic lower back pain that have come and gone over my career, but this one has staying power because it's a root cause treatment. This procedure will shift the treatment paradigm of spine care into the new field of regenerative medicine. I will share with you real patient stories from my clinical practice at one of the busiest orthopedic hospitals in the world and from my private clinic, the Regenerative Sports Care Institute, RSI, in Manhattan. The patient names have been changed, but their stories and MRI images are real. Are you a good potential candidate for regenerative medicine? While regenerative treatments offer new hope for patients suffering from chronic lower back pain, they are not always successful and are not without risk. This field has been historically less regulated than other areas of medicine because it does not involve the use of a drug. This lack of regulation creates a confusing landscape for a patient with chronic lower back pain to try to navigate on their own. I will walk you through this decision-making process step by step to ensure you protect your spine from ineffective and poorly conceived treatments. I will educate you regarding what I feel is currently not only the most effective, but also the safest regenerative treatment to consider. I will also give you some insights on how to find a reputable regenerative spine specialist to potentially treat you. How will we make this paradigm shift towards regenerative medicine? The way our healthcare system has managed chronic lower back pain is overdue for a radical change, but change is difficult. There are so many entrenched players in healthcare that can create barriers and resistance to change. For regenerative medicine to become mainstream, we will need to overcome them. I'll share my thoughts on a strategy that could work called vertical collaboration. It places the needs of the patient at the core and uses scientific evidence to make rational healthcare decisions. I left the confines of a hospital to open RSI, further my research in regenerative medicine, and offer my patients this new treatment option in a more personalized environment. Unlike most hospitals, which focus on surgery, RSI's goal is to preserve the disc and spine with non-surgical care. Our primary focus is on finding a cure for lower back pain, the most common, the most disabling, and the most expensive musculoskeletal problem humans face. I feel the answer lies in healing painful tears in the discs early on in the disease process with nothing more than a special concentration of your own cells. What I've learned is that the needle is mightier than the scalpel when it comes to the treatment of chronic lower back pain, and your body is your best surgeon. If we can heal your disc, we can end your pain and hopefully halt or reverse degenerative disc disease. In the next chapter, you will learn just how prevalent and costly chronic lower back pain is, not just in the United States, but also globally. How chronic lower back pain is a pandemic in its own right, and how most treatments have been ineffective, causing too many patients to take long-term opioids or undergo needless spinal surgeries. How the economic magnitude of this healthcare problem is staggering, and a paradigm shift in its treatment is long overdue.